Hey, welcome back. Okay, here we go. This is what we've been building up to. More than 150 books entered for this year's William Hill Sports Book of the Year Prize. A record number of entries there. An extraordinary effort by all the publishers, given the limitations and restrictions we've been living under during this year. We narrowed that number of entries down to a long list of 15. The judges brought it down further to just 5, and they've now decided on the winner. And of course, the winner gets a £30,000 prize, a leather-bound copy of the book, but more importantly, the prestige of being named the winner of the world's biggest prize in sports writing. Now, just a quick reminder of who were those 5 shortlisted books. We had Born Fighter by Roxana Begum, The World Beneath Their Feet by Scott Ellsworth, The Unforgiven by Ashley Gray, The Breath of Sadness by Ian Ridley, and The Rodchenkov Affair by Dr. Grigory Rodchenkov. So, who's won? Well, normally we would be having an award ceremony in central London. It was always a highlight for me in the build-up to Christmas, but for obvious reasons, that couldn't happen this year. So, our chair of the judges, Alison Rudd, made the announcement live on TalkSport.
Well, it's my great privilege as chair of the judging panel to announce that the winner of the William Hill Sports Book of the Year 2020 is The Rodchenkov Affair by Dr. Grigory Rodchenkov. As we went through the discussions, words were used like groundbreaking, important, crucial, game-changing. It's a book like no other.
A very, very interesting choice. The Rodchenkov Affair, How I Brought Down Putin's Secret Doping Empire by Dr. Grigory Rodchenkov, winning the William Hill Sports Book of the Year Prize for 2020. Now, that book charts his childhood, growing up behind the Iron Curtain, his early experience of doping, but more importantly, his later career as the head of the anti-doping lab, whilst simultaneously being a senior player in Russia's doping program. It details internal conflicts at the Kremlin, brazen cheating by that nation's athletes, and when it became clear that he was going to be the one left holding the can at the end of this, he turned whistleblower. It led to him going on the run in America, where he lives in exile. You're given the impression reading the book that he doesn't sleep under the same roof for very long. There are even rumours that he's had plastic surgery to try to conceal his identity. And for obvious reasons, therefore, he is not giving interviews. So we were very fortunate to speak to Drummond Moyer, who is the editor and publisher of this book at Ebury Penguin Random House. Well, first of all, Drummond, congratulations. Sports Book of the Year.
Thanks very much. Yeah, we're very pleased. This is obviously a book that was written in secret and published in clandestine circumstances and released to the world amidst lots of lockdowns. So it's really great for us and for Grigory that his story is now getting this acclaim and this attention that we've always felt it really deserved. So we're really thrilled about the prize.
Absolutely. And we need to come on to the sort of circumstances for this, because as you say, the whole world has had a lockdown for much of 2020, which has obviously made many jobs difficult. And I'll no doubt that has affected you in the publishing world as well. But we need to talk about the fact that this is a book written under very, very unusual circumstances, because Grigory is, as anyone familiar with his situation is concerned, knows, he is on the run for his life in America. How on earth does he manage to write a book?
Well, he had begun writing the book shortly after, I believe, he went into witness protection. He did have a number of diaries that he was writing, that he was drawing on. I mean, I might actually answer that by saying that in a strange way, what a lot of potential authors have found this year, since March, since lockdown started happening, is that they've actually had more time to write than they might have otherwise. And I don't want to speak for Grigory, but, you know, once he was granted asylum and was in hiding in undisclosed locations in the US, I think he probably did actually have time to reflect on his experience and to express it in his own words. And, you know, in a way, all you need in order to write a book, at least in a first draft, is access to either typewriter or Microsoft Word or something similar. Although I gather Obama did write his 700-page memoir in longhand. So, I say there are lots of ways you can do it, and Grigory obviously found a way to do it despite his challenging circumstances.
Having read the book, I know that there are no acknowledgements. Often with these kind of books, you'll have a sort of section at the end, which is acknowledgements. And I have to say, as I was midway through the book, I did search for acknowledgements because I wondered, has anyone helped him write this? It appears to be entirely his own work. Is that right?
It's definitely Grigory's own work. It's his own words and his own voice. He does have, you know, a team around him, and he did draw on some advice and guidance from a colleague of his who is bilingual, who speaks Russian and English, and I know that was certainly helpful. But no, in terms of the words and the experience and the story and the language, it's all very much from the horse's mouth.
So how would it work then, Drummond, given that this is a guy who's on run for his life and obviously isn't going to be revealing his location to anyone, I'm guessing, not even to you. So how are the manuscripts arriving to you? How were you getting to see how this book was progressing?
We always treat every book with a kind of basic degree of confidentiality and security, whether that is an author who's writing a novel and sends it in as a Word document via email. You know, obviously we would only share that with you know, select people in house, for example. At the other end of the spectrum, the very extreme end of the spectrum is this. So with Grigory's book, you know, we had a number of measures in place that would create a kind of hyper-vigilant, hyper-secure experience for him. So, for example, we didn't communicate at all via email. It was all through encrypted email servers. We would not mention his name prior to the book being published on any phone call that wasn't through, again, a secure line or a mode such as Signal, you know, which is more secure than, you know, picking up the phone. And it was basically using various methods and modes of communicating that we know from our experience as publishers are safe and secure and, as you say, more secure than the kind of standard methods. So, you know, I would receive draft chapters and eventually a full draft of the book from Grigory through one of these modes, these, you know, protected encrypted email servers. I wouldn't keep anything in my computer, and we didn't keep anything on our, you know, internal servers, although they're very secure. We didn't have anything going on people's personal laptops. And anything that was printed was immediately shredded and destroyed. So there were not, you know, this was not a situation where we had, you know, any of the content, any of the material accessible to anyone really other than me all the way through. And then, you know, when it comes to the kind of subsequent stages, and sorry, this may not be as interesting a side of it, but, you know, everyone thinks, you know, you write a book and then it's finished. And from the author's point of view, you know, once the book is finished as a Word document, it's kind of complete. There are then many subsequent stages on the publishing side, which is why sometimes publishing can feel like it takes a bit longer. Although we do move very quickly, you have copy editing, you have typesetting, you have proofreading, you have indexing, you have plates, you have legal reads. All of that had to be done extremely securely as well. So, you know, NDAs and other security systems were put in place for things like typesetting. And, you know, fortunately for us, you know, we have a lot of experience working in books that require this type of vigilance and security. And at no point, you know, were we doing anything that we felt was... I mean, this is all agreed with Grigory and his team, obviously, but we felt we were able to, you know, create the book that he and we wanted to create despite these obstacles.
Fascinating. It's an unflinchingly honest account by Grigory. And I think I remember reading it in the summer. I read this book in one sitting on a summer's afternoon. It is absolutely riveting. When I say, though, it's honest, it strikes me, Drummond, that he doesn't care whether you like him, but it's very important to him that he knows that we believe him. Because, bluntly, some of the things that he says within the book, you wouldn't be saying if you wanted to win any friends. For example, his views on doping. He believes, or he says in the book, you know, doping levels the playing field. Well, those of us who love sport would say, no, I don't want drugs involved in sport. But he's clearly saying that because that's what he believes.
Yeah, I think that's right. My only qualification there would be to say that I think in that section he does kind of preface that by saying, you know, let me advance a view that some of you may find controversial, or let me put another unconventional argument in front of you. So I think what he does really well in the book is it is unflinchingly honest, and it absolutely doesn't hold back from saying some things that you may not want to hear. I mean, there's another point in the book where he says, you know, when you play by the rules, you lose. And that's a really hard thing to hear if you believe in fairness and you know the kind of basic ideals that lie underneath all competitive sport. The thing I would say, though, is that he's not in any way asking you to go along with that or insisting that you agree with him. And he certainly isn't at any point painting himself as an angel. And, you know, I think that's something he does really well in the book. And it was a really interesting element to the editing and the publishing of the book, was that, you know, we all felt very strongly that the first thing the reader needs to see in this book is a statement from Grigory about why he's written the book and what he expects from you, the reader. So on page one of the book, before you have that amazing opening scene of him, you know, as a 22-year-old on the couch being injected with anabolic steroids with his trousers down by his mother, who's a gynecological surgeon. You know, before you have that opening scene, before you have the kind of cast of characters, before you have all of the kind of glossary of key terms, you have a statement from Grigory on page one that says, all I'm doing here is telling you the truth. I won't remember his exact words here, sorry, but you know, he essentially says, you know, I'm not asking you to agree with me. I'm not asking you to forgive me. I'm not trying to excuse myself. All I'm going to do is tell you the truth. And we all felt that was really important for that the reason that you bring up. You know, he has some experiences and some views that are not always going to be palatable to everybody. And, you know, there's a reputational issue here as well, because obviously as a publisher, we have to draw a distinction between something that people might find offensive and something that people might find harmful. And, you know, in this instance, we felt that, you know, and Grigory felt this as well, it wouldn't be appropriate to try and claim that he's a completely flawless individual. But equally, you know, where he has these controversial views, they have to be presented as that rather than as fact. So we all felt that the best balance and the most responsible and accurate and honest way to present him and this book was to have that statement on page one saying, as you say, like, you're not going to like everything you read here, but if you're on board with that, dive in, and you get, as you said, you know, a book that you can read in one sitting that is unflinchingly and uniquely honest, I think.
I can't speak obviously for the judges, but my instinct is that it was that honesty that has been a major factor in the book winning the prize. And does Grigory know that he's won?
He does, and he's thrilled.
I'll bet. What an amazing book to have been involved in. Drummond, I'm so happy you could join us on the podcast for this, and congratulations again on the Rutschenko for winning the William Hill Sports Book of the Year for 2020.
Thank you.
Extraordinary stuff from Drummond there. There's a couple of things that I've noted down from that interview. One is the length that they clearly went to keep this confidential. They wouldn't even say his name on the phone. No emails, shredding any paper documents after meetings. Goodness me. And also the balance that they were striving to achieve, given that they were publishing a book where the writer was espousing some views that many of us would find abhorrent. Really, really interesting, fascinating stuff from Drummond. Let's hear now from Alison Rudd. As I mentioned before, she's the chair of our judges, and let's talk to her about why the judges chose the Rutschenko Affair as this year's winner.
Well, it was a book that sparked intense debate, as I'm sure you can imagine, because it's a very difficult subject matter which reaches into realms of politics, morality, the future of sport, the impact a book can make, the veracity of the book, the fact that it's linked to a film. That was one of the, believe it or not, one of the issues under discussion. But if you think about it, a book that sparks so much debate amongst all the judges and the chair, in some way, looking back now, it was inevitably going to be the winner, because although there was lots to discuss and we went into great detail, because the judging panel does take this terribly seriously, not one of the judges dismissed it or hated it or had it as a book that they really felt should not win the award. It was a book that intrigued them, they felt was very powerful, and to varying degrees, everyone on the panel felt it was a very important book. So although it was a very strong shortlist, there was a lot of emotional passion for some titles. I think each judge had a book they felt emotionally attached to. Possibly one or two even more emotionally attached than they were to the winner. It's not just about your emotional attachment to a book, it's about the bigger picture. And I think overall the panel, if I can speak of them as a collective, because they all had a different take on this, the feeling was that this might be one of the most important books written about sport, whether that heralds the end of athletics or indicates this is just the tip of the iceberg. There might be so much more that this book ought to have told us and does not. Regardless, it's extremely important. In varying degrees, I think everyone can accept it was a brave book to write as well. I mean, in the introduction, you only have to read the introduction to know you're in for a hell of a ride with this one. I mean, he says, I live in protect. This is Dr. Gregory. He says, I live in protective custody, in the proverbial undisclosed location, and whenever I leave my small apartment, I am accompanied by one or sometimes two armed guards. On occasion, I wear a bulletproof vest. Most books you write about sport don't lead to you having to do that. So it's definitely a book you have to take seriously. And then the panel discussed its merits, and it was, I think, a very worthy winner.
Were you struck as well by the fact this appears to be, it's his own work. It's been written by him. There's no ghostwriter here. And in fact, it's his, we on this podcast last week, we heard from Brian Fogel, who of course did the documentary, the Icarus documentary with Dr. Rutschenkov. And he revealed that basically Rutschenkov had written this entirely himself based on his own diaries that he had kept and some documents that he'd smuggled out of Russia when he was fleeing for his life. Were those sort of elements part of the panel's discussion, or was it just, this is the book and this is why we like it?
No, well, it was a small element of it. I think definitely the how good a read it is, how well written it is, how from the heart it is written. I suspect if there'd been a ghostwriter involved, it might have struggled to win. Possibly that is a consideration. Definitely, it's definitely whether you like him or not as a person, and you know, people have said to me outside of this, when they saw the shortlist, they've sort of gasped and said, how, you know, is that going to win? Because aren't you rewarding a baddie, basically? But I think that's a bit simplistic, because whistleblowing invariably means you make enemies. It invariably means, you know, not everyone who whistleblows is on the outside looking in and has no part of what they're telling you happened. And this is, you know, we can only imagine what it's like growing up. I mean, Dr. Grigory is part of the Russian system. And I think, to me, that was one of the most powerful elements of the book. He was a very, very intelligent man who loved sport and a talented scientist. If you are those things and you are growing up in the environment he was, where he it feels like he knew he was growing up inside an Orwell novel, in a sense, that things were... He had logic and intelligence, but he also had to toe the party line and be fearful of doing or saying the wrong thing. So it felt to me like he was leading two parallel moral lives throughout, and there came a tipping point for him. And I did honestly feel that maybe he was writing the book somewhere in his deep subconscious from the age of 15, maybe, when he realised that people were overtaking him on the running track because... Well, you know, that's what you do. You have to take steroids or whatever the current drug of choice is to get better. So, and get faster. And you were deemed stupid if you didn't take them. He grew up in that culture. Who are we, growing up in the culture we have, to say that makes him, you know, morally bereft? It's a different way of growing up and having the strength of character to address everything that was normal in your career and in your upbringing, and then see it and decide, right, okay, this has to be told, is, I think, on balance, it's a brave thing to do.
You've mentioned already that this was a strong shortlist that you had this year. There were some extraordinary books there that, and you've mentioned as well that some of the other judges had strong emotional attachments to. Clearly, it was up against some very stiff competition.
Yep, I mean, it was... I knew it was going to be... I knew it was going to be one of those panels where... It's going to be really hard to knock the book down. I say that because often, not always, but often over the years, and I've been doing this a long time, although this was only my second in the chair, to make things simpler, you try and sort of knock a book down early on. It becomes clear that this book, whilst liked and admired to enough for it to have gained traction to make the shortlist, is nobody's real passion. It was really hard to do that this year. Every time I tried to knock a book down, someone would groan. Oh no, 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 no! I still want to fight for that one. So it was and it did again. And this was testament to the panel. A lot of the movement and the ability to come to a decision was because one or two judges listened to the objections of the other judges. And, you know, we're prepared. And it's hard to do this, isn't it? They're prepared to think, well, actually, I was really fighting for that book, but I take on board that point. And actually, maybe on balance, I was too drawn to this element, and I'm gonna allow it to go because I see what they're saying. So I think that's utterly remarkable. And I've rarely done it myself. When I was a judge, I would cling to my original view. And it was very hard for anyone to persuade me to change my mind. So I admired them enormously for listening. They listened to each other, and those that had thought through the flaws. Because, I mean, yes, it's a really strong shortlist, but, you know, there's always a flaw in most books. They listened to the flaws or the arguments why it might not be a worthy winner, and were able to back down to let a very good winner emerge. It was exhausting, Matt.
I can only imagine. Only imagine. So, well, the good news is that obviously William Hill are going to be doing this prize next year, which we are hoping is going to be a easier year all round than 2020 has been. So a 33rd year for the prize. The £30,000 prize will be there for the winner in December of 2021. And entries are open now, Alison. So, well, give us some details. When do the entries need to be in by? What are the publication dates? What information can you give us on that?
Okay, well, there's time. There's time for people to get their act together. The entries close on Friday, the 20th of August, and they must be received by William Hill by the 27th of August, which is a Friday. Try not to leave it that long. It's amazing how many people do. And you qualify to enter if the book is published between the 13th of October 2020 and the 1st of September 2021, which is fairly straightforward, I hope. You can contact William Hill if you want more information. It's Whizbotty, WHSBOTY, at williamhill.co.uk. Or you can go at Bookie Prize to enter. And I'm sure we'll be heavily over social media to remind people.
I would also recommend, having been one of the people who was drawing up the long list for this year, I would say do not leave it until August to enter your book, because your book is being judged not by a team of robots, but by a team of human beings. And bluntly, if you decide to send your book in when it's published in March or April, it's more likely to get a fur reading than if it's in a mountain of books at the end of August. That's just a very personal thought from me. I know as well, Alison, I was at the when we were able to hold ceremonies, which feels like a different world altogether. But I was at the ceremony in 2019, and I listened to your address then when you were saying that you wanted a more diverse range of entries this year. Were you happy with the diversity of entries for this year, or do you have a call for next year for entrance?
Well, I was happy that there is a some traction in people listening to that, but it's still not good enough. There were 10 of the 152 books were by female writers, and I think just as importantly, if not more, only 6 of the books were written about women. Women play sport too, women are involved in sport, women are important figures in sport, they deserve to have their stories told, and I'm pretty darn sure they're just as interesting as men's stories. One of them, of course, did make the shortlist, Born Fighter, which was excellent. I recommend everybody reads it. It reads like a thriller. It's an incredibly good book. But it'd be quite nice if the shortlist had, three books about women and 2 about men 1 year. That would be fantastic. So please, publishers, don't assume that it's only male sports that sell or are interesting. A lot of the books over the years that have won the William Hill Award they've won not because they're about somebody famous or some big event. They've won because the story is emotional and incredible, and sport produces that. Sport has the power of everything together that makes it makes you want to laugh and cry within one book. And that doesn't have to be a male story. It can be a female story too.
It's also important to say you've got to be in it to win it. Don't expect us to come knocking at your door unless you've decided to enter the prize. I can't think of any prize anywhere in the world, from the Oscars to Best Kept Garden, that you win without entering it. So please, please enter. Quite right. Many thanks, Alison. Thank you again for chairing the judges this year and picking such an interesting choice, the Rodchenkov Affair, winning the William Hill Sportsbook of the Year 2020. Alison, many thanks.
Thank you.
A real insight into the judging process there from Alison. Let me just repeat the details of how to enter for next year's prize. You can email WHSBOTY at williamhill.co.uk, WHSBOTY, obviously standing for William Hill Sportsbook of the Year, at williamhill.co.uk. You can also contact us on social media. On Twitter, it's at Bookie Prize. Now, books need to have been published between the 13th of October this year and the 1st of September 2021. But entries close on the 20th of August 2021. And as I mentioned in that interview with Alison, I would heartily recommend getting books in early, because there's always a mountain of them that arrive in late summer. So there we are. We have a winner, an extraordinary book in an extraordinary year. The Rodchenkov Affair by Dr. Grigory Rodchenkov, winner of the William Hill Sports Book of the Year 2020. It is a choice that will generate debate. And all I would say there is you do not have to admire Dr. Rodchenkov. You don't have to particularly like him. However, the astonishing detail that's provided within this book of doping on an industrial scale is extraordinary. And I would heartily recommend picking this book out and giving it a read. I hope you've enjoyed these podcasts. If you've missed any of our previous episodes, they're still available on our feed. There's some really insightful interviews with our shortlisted writers there. William Hill, of course, already opening entries for next year. So the very next time we'll be talking on this podcast, hopefully, will be with 2020 firmly in our rearview mirror. We'll all drink to that, I think. But I hope you have a great Christmas, and we'll speak to you soon.